First he asked if I'd like to take my shirt off, but I said no.
Objection. The abuse has been admitted. My learned friend is just going over the facts that are no longer in dispute.
The very reason we're here is that she has never been allowed to tell her story. The defendant has never wanted to hear it, Your Honour.
Australians have a heightened awareness of the issue of child sex abuse at the moment. A high-profile royal commission with an unprecedented remit has been investigating crimes against children in schools, churches and youth organisations for the past few years, and it's approaching its conclusion in December. This week, a new film dramatises a key court case that helped inspire this current push for justice. It's called Don't Tell. Hi, I'm Jason DeRosso. That review coming up, plus I'll speak to a member of the cast, veteran actor Jack Thompson. Then I'm stepping out of the cinema briefly today and into the art gallery to speak to a video artist who's using an algorithm to tell stories. Oh, and there's a new action movie with Keanu Reeves, John Wick 2.
I'll kill them all.
It's bonkers. You're listening to RN's weekly show about film and screen, The Final Cut.
You can be very proud of this school, Bob.
Thank you, Archbishop. Should I say Governor General?
It doesn't make any difference. I'm still God's humble servant.
Are you sure we can't tempt you with some morning tea?
I have to push on, I'm afraid. My time's not my own anymore.
This case that's been filed against the school and the church.
We are dealing with that.
Make sure you keep my name out of it.
The lawyers are very confident we can settle cheaply.
Very good.
Releasing on a respectable 80 screens around the country this week is the Australian courtroom drama Don't Tell, about a young Toowoomba woman who took the Anglican Church to court in 2001 for the sexual abuse she suffered at one of their schools. Although her tormentor, one of her teachers, had killed himself years earlier, her aim was to prove the church knew about him and did nothing.
If we go to trial, this becomes public. Every sordid detail in your life, from then until now, all of it, will be under the microscope. You'll feel like you're the one on trial.
Do you want to do it or not?
She is too volatile to go to court, Steve.
He said don't tell.
For a case that would send tremors through the Australian political establishment, even shaking the ground beneath the country's highest chair, the film begins in a modest register, a story of an overworked but idealistic small-town lawyer, played by Aidan Young, and his volatile yet determined young client, Lyndall, played by Sarah West. It unfolds very much as a procedural, with a familiar series of promising leads and dead ends, reluctant witnesses and unexpected breakthroughs. First-time feature director Tori Garrett marshals an impressive, well-drilled cast, including Jack Thompson as Lyndall's courtroom advocate, Jacqueline McKenzie, his opposite number, and Rachel Griffiths as a counsellor. Unfortunately, many other secondary characters seem to miss out. The jurors, who are so often mirrors in which we see our own reflection in courtroom dramas, are barely given a line of dialogue. Even Lyndall's parents, played by Susie Porter and Martin Sachs, remain underdrawn. It's as if the trio of TV writers who adapted the book, written by Young's real-life character Stephen Roche, couldn't quite find the right composition for their fresco of heroes, villains, and interested bystanders. Aidan Young is at the centre of the picture for a lot of the time, battling his more cynical or perhaps more realistic older colleague on the one hand, dealing with Lyndall's frequent emotional outbursts on the other, while all the while trying to be there for his young family, who miss him. And yet, ultimately, it's not really his story, or at least the film doesn't give him that, as it shifts focus to Thompson's glory in court, and ultimately, of course, Sarah West's Lyndall.
They're going to win, Steve, because they got more money, more lawyers, and they're all smarter than you.
She is, by the way, fantastic in the film. To sustain a performance that's perched on a knife edge between vulnerability and defiance for a whole film is a credit to her and to Garrett. But compare Don't Tell to the Oscar-winning Spotlight, another film about a specific set of crimes against children, and it's clear how much more focused and sharply political the American film was. Don't Tell is subtle in reminding us that this court case was the beginning of the end for Australia's Governor-General Peter Hollingworth because of his role as Brisbane's Anglican Archbishop when Lyndall's abuse occurred. It stops short of suggesting church indifference is emblematic of a pattern in Australian history where the powerful have continually turned a blind eye to past wrongs. That parallel is there to be made, however. What Don't Tell does try and do is depict, though far too late, I think, how cowardice afflicts the human soul. When Lindor's former school principal takes the stand, you catch a glimpse, finally, of a man who knows he's given in to an unforgivable compromise. Jack Thompson's final speech articulates what we, the audience, already know, that an absence of justice for Lindell erodes our integrity as a community. You feel like the film might have found a way to make this point earlier, but instead it plays out in a more black and white binary, focusing on characters who seem much less conflicted. It's a question perhaps of favouring plot over theme. Spotlight was just as full of procedural detail and characters, but with a better script it somehow cuts straight through the layers to the core issues, sometimes visually, with the way it framed shots of suburban houses overlooked by ominous church steeples. While Don't Tell does conjure some images that speak up powerfully, they're not quite given the space they need. A close-up of Lindell on a train platform with a bottle in her hand as a series of freight carriages rattle through the back of shot, for example, is crowded out by dialogue. A school ballet concert that's a sudden burst of colour and innocence is over too soon for it to really disrupt the flow of the film with a reminder of what's at stake in crimes like this. Don't Tell is two films in a way, the film it is and the film it could have been. To its credit, the distance between the two is sometimes not much at all, but it never completely disappears. Torchlight on you. Here's Jack Thompson.
What attracted me to the script was that it's a real story. Nobody has invented what was said in the court, and it is the seminal case involved in the Royal Commission. It was this that triggered the Royal Commission. It was the resignation of the Governor General, and subsequently it was Julia Gillard who instigated the Royal Commission. It's also a well-told tale about the extraordinary courage and determination of a young woman. You see Sarah West's performance as Lindell. Her performance is the most beautiful thing. It rides this sort of dangerous edge between bitter rejection, stuff you, and total vulnerability.
I agree with you that it's a fantastic performance from her. Mm. Your character, on the other hand, of course, is the veteran barrister, very sort of secure of his own powers, in a sense. What did you think of your character? Did you meet the real-life person?
I did meet the real-life person. I met Bob. In fact, when I came on board, I said I'd like to meet him, if that's possible. I'd like to get a feel for the character. I don't want to imitate the man, but I want to get a feel for the character and what motivated him. When I said, can I get a photo of Bob? A photo was sent to me, and it was a photo of he and I standing together. And I realised that I had met Bob at the memorial service for a mutual friend, dear old Ron Finney, who was one of the people who set up with Bob the first Aboriginal legal service in Brisbane. I thought, oh, that's the man. So that gave me an extra dimension to this man, an understanding of how he felt about the community. And I asked him, what made you persist? And, you know, in the beginning he said, you know, this is pretty tough. The girl's not going to be easy to handle in court and da-da-da-da. What made you persist? He said, have you met the girl? I said, no, I haven't at this stage. He said, well, when you do, you'll see. The courage in that young woman, that's what made me persist.
Even though they commit acts which, calmly viewed afterwards, could only be seen as unchristian and brutal. And if in every war, particularly guerrilla war, all the men who committed reprisals were to be charged and tried as murderers, court-martials like this one would be in permanent session.
It's not the first time, of course, you played a legal man. Oh, no. Seems to crop up a bit in your career.
Yes, well, I don't mind it cropping up a bit in my career.
Looking back on your career, you know, are there moments that really stick out for you as being those moments where you think, well, if that hadn't happened, the rest wouldn't have come afterwards? I don't know, the Breaker Morant sort of moment, the accolade there at Cannes.
For me, practically every movie I've done is such a thing. This film, I think, is a turning point. Here I am, a senior actor. Here I am, given this extraordinary role of advocacy that has attracted the attention of a lot of people. When we were in America for the film festival, it also happened to be the month of the prevention of child abuse. There is a focus on it through the Royal Commission. I happen to be playing this man at this time. That brings attention to me as an actor and what I'm doing now.
So timing really has been, I mean, it's an essential part of everyone's career, especially successful careers, yeah. I guess. I mean, do you feel quite blessed, or is timing also what you make it? You know, do you construct
the words from me? I do feel blessed. I do. My career has been a blessed career. I began working as a professional actor in 1968, 1969, Wake and Fright, and the beginnings of a renaissance of an Australian film industry. This young actor was riding that wave of enthusiasm in filmmaking in this country. I've seen it grow, and I've been a part of that growth. You can't design that. You happen to be there at that time. But if you can't ride the wave, there's no point in being there.
Australian actor Jack Thompson, Don't Tell, is in current release around the country. And tune into Screen Sounds on ABC Classic FM this week, where they're showcasing some of the score. It's always a great show for lovers of film. You're listening to The Final Cut.
Allô?
Oui.
Salut, ça va?
Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé? Ta sœur est complètement paniquée.
Stepping out of the cinema now and into the gallery space, a place where a lot of filmmakers do often take time to explore more radical ideas that they can't get up in cinema. Artist and filmmaker Zanny Begg has co-written and co-directed a video installation with Paris-based Australian Elise McLeod called The City of Ladies, which you can see as part of the National Exhibition at Sydney's Museum of Contemporary Art. The City of Ladies is inspired by the 15th century feminist novel of the same name by French author Christine de Pizan, which imagined a female utopia. The video installation is a project that threads the dramatised stories of five young Parisian women who come together during an anti-austerity march. Documentary footage, as well as guest appearances by prominent feminist scholars, blend into scripted scenes. But if this balancing act wasn't audacious enough, the 20 or so minute film is in continuous evolution as it replays on a loop, because its scenes are compiled randomly by an algorithm. Now, before you think this sounds like a recipe for disaster, it actually works wonderfully. No two screenings of the film are the same, and so it plays forever in continual evolution. The effect, as I say, is quite wonderful, which says a lot about the way that the individual elements were carefully designed to mean different things in different contexts. I was so taken by The City of Ladies, I had to get Zanny Begg into the studio to find out more.
Elise and I have been friends since we were 14, and I pitched to her that we would combine our strengths. So she's a film director and I'm a visual artist, and so let's work on a project together. And our common interest was women, or feminism, and film. So we thought, okay, let's do a project around that. And we did heaps of research, and we discovered this incredible book that had been written in Paris in 1402, which is considered the first Western feminist text, and it's called The City of Ladies, which is a great name. And it is a feminist utopia, where this medieval writer imagines Paris as a city that's built, governed, and populated by women. So we thought, well, that's our starting point. And so before I got to Paris, I actually wrote a script, I guess as a sort of idea. I did heaps of research about feminism in France and what was happening in France with the terrorist attacks and the Nuit Debout movement and the labour struggles and so forth.
And this was all happening, the Nuit Debout, you pronounce it better than me, happened, sort of began around March 2016. It was like the Parisian version of the Occupy movement,
but it was
protesting a certain raft of labour law changes.
Well, it was that, and also it was this really beautiful, very French thing where after the terrorist attacks and the really draconian response by the state, a lot of young people would gather at the Place de la République at night and just sit down and spend all night talking together. And the idea was to create trusting public space where the whole of the discourse was around mistrust in public space. And so it was very utopian, and that was a natural sort of connection with this earlier medieval utopian idea. So we were interested in finding, working with that really old text, it's 800 years old, across time. And so it wouldn't just look at the same set of issues that were happening in 1402, but the lens would be similar, which would be how is all these issues related to misogyny? Like, what is it about how we treat women that is connected to how we, to colonisation, to the ramifications of the post-colonial world, terrorism, war, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So you've got several teenage girls in this film who are attending these protests, and part of this film happens in the street, and then the film branches off into, if I can call it a film, well, I'm calling it, I don't know, it's a video installation.
It's an experience.
Yeah, absolutely. That, you know, it branches off into their individual stories, I suppose. Did they help you write it? They look like first-time actors, which is not to sort of underplay their wonderful performances, but there's a freshness there. Did they bring their stories to the table?
Absolutely. We had actually 500 women apply to be in the film, which was massive. So we narrowed it down to 30 who said they were feminists and were in some way connected to the movement, and we interviewed them. And then of that, we picked 7 women who could act, like had acting skills, but were also activists. So they could be comfortable in the kind of documentary sequences, which are shot during a protest, which actually ended up being tear gassed and, you know, very sort of French style, got quite sort of heavy. And so they had to be comfortable in that environment that, you know, that was their landscape. But then also we have these fiction sequences and these utopian sequences where, you know, it's their acting skills that need to come to the fore.
Now, tell me about this algorithm, because this is the remarkable thing about it. I think the film, when you don't know, and I didn't know it was an algorithm, someone had mentioned to me there's software involved and so forth. And look, I was looking for a visual sort of sense of transformation, but it's quite structural. Tell me how the algorithm works.
Okay, so the film is basically made like a bunch of spaghetti, in a sense that there's a whole lot of stories which are modular and can be connected in different ways. So there's over 300,000 variations. And the idea is every 20 minutes you get a different film. So you may go and see a film. 20 minutes later, your friend goes to see the film. You have coffee later, you have talk, and you're seeing different films, different stories. The reason we did this is because feminism is complicated. It's multifaceted. It's dynamic. So, yeah, obviously a lot of different issues are brought up by the film around Islamophobia, around class, around transgender issues, around racism and so forth. And I guess the reason that we chose this nonlinear structure is that we weren't trying to kind of homogenize any of those experiences into one overarching narrative. If you end up on the stream that goes in that direction, you're going to find out those stories. If you end up on a different stream, you're going to end up hearing different stories. And our idea was not to homogenize them back into one teleological narrative. It is multiple. And I think that is the only way that feminism, it's feminisms, not feminism. It's the only way feminism can exist is by actually having space for difference.
It was fascinating for me not knowing this, seeing it, because I noticed obviously the subtle repetitions and sometimes quite obvious repetitions, but they came across to me as rich gestures, I suppose, in the tradition of filmmakers like Hong Sang-soo, but filmmakers who deal in repetition and variation. It's almost a musical kind. There's a musicality to it. It's almost a musical concept.
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny you should mention music. I'm going to digress a little bit here, but music is actually really important to the project. And one of the songs that we picked, which comes through repeatedly through that repetition in the film, is the Eagles of Death Metal song, Who Loves the Devil, which was actually what was playing in the Bataclan when the terrorists opened fire. So it has this really visceral history in France. We didn't want to directly use that song, so we actually got a Sydney feminist punk band, Mere Women, to cover the song so that it had the female voice. But the lyrics are actually, who loves the devil, who'll sing his song? I love the devil, I'll sing his song. So for
us... that's really interesting given all the themes of witchcraft and so forth in the film. Yeah. Also kind of subverts Eagles of Death Metal's quite macho and possibly right-wing.
Absolutely, everything and above, yeah. I mean, that song for us really kind of plumbed down to what we were looking at was that Christine de Pizan, when she was writing this book, it was just before the witch trials in Europe really had hit full stream. So that's the 15th and 16th century. She was writing in a bit earlier, just before that. But she saw that misogyny. And, you know, we don't know how many women died at that period of time, but approximately 40,000 in a very, very brutal and public way. It was a shock and awe campaign against women, which the church has never apologized for. So I think one of the lines that kind of ends all the different film versions is, if you think history is on your side, let me remind you, women didn't write these books. If they had, the stories would be different.
Vendredi 13 novembre, dans la nuit. Des centaines de personnes sont tuées, blessées à Paris.
Does the idea of the algorithm randomly organising these carefully scripted and carefully recorded, in some cases where it's more documentary, modules of narrative, does it undermine your sense of authorship? Or is it a bit like, you know, a video game writer who sort of has to write within parameters, sets up elements, but knows that those elements will be, you know, reorganized and sort of experienced in different sequences by different players?
I actually love the process of editing this film. I mean, it took probably 8 to 12 months of my life to put it together, but I absolutely love the process of it because in a way you did actually have to give in to the algorithm. There was this sense that you can have a plan of how you want the story to unfold, but what's going to happen in the algorithm is accidents. Because it's made up of multiple tiny scenes, it's not only what happens within those scenes, it's the ordering of those scenes, and that can really change meaning. You know,
and the repetition of them, of course.
Yeah. And the repetition of them. And the software programming for us was done by Andrew Nicholson, and he was staunch about the idea that we should just go for randomization rather than any sort of tweaking, because I was a bit nervous about that. It's like, what if someone gets the same story twice? And he was like, well, that's random. You can get the same story twice. So maybe in some ways people might be disappointed that they, you know, they get another scene twice. But then also within that allows these kind of these happy accidents or these accidental meanings or these other things to emerge, which I think also has sort of a magic that's kind of more important than whether someone gets a repetition of the same scene twice.
A certain conventional reading of gender would describe what you're talking about as being I don't know if it being a feminine way of telling stories, but certainly in a non-masculine way. You know, that conventional thing is always attributing to the masculine a sense of imposing one's will on the material, and this is my story and I'm telling it this way. And the way, you know, and you really are ceding control to the algorithm. and you know what I mean.
I'm not sure if that's feminist or not. Yeah. But, we were certainly trying to mess with this idea of time and that, you know, this linear notion of time, which is very masculinist. And we were thinking about, well, can time be circular? Are there loops in time? Is there repetition? You know, a lot of those things, I guess,
well, it's very come Western. Out of... That's true. And it's very Western too, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, the colonial Western vision, which, you know, we have all been shaped by, either in reaction against or through kind of profiting from, or, you know, whatever our place along that spectrum. But it's certainly something that I think its time has come, you know, and it through, if you look through the lens of misogyny, there's many other race and other lenses you can look through. But if you look through the lens of misogyny alone, it's a crisis point of legitimacy for that kind of system and that kind of thinking. So our project, we hope, is in some small way of trying to challenge that and think about there's an alternative world that we could live in.
Zanny Begg, co-director of The City of Ladies, a fascinating video installation which may very well have plans to travel. Check out Zanny's website, but if you're in Sydney, do visit the Museum of Contemporary Art to see it right now.
I'd like to see the manager.
How good to see you again so soon, Mr. Wick. Shall I announce you?
Yes, please.
Before I go, a mention of John Wick 2, the second installment of the action franchise, featuring a menacing Keanu Reeves in the role of a hitman who just wants to retire and snuggle a puppy. But he's dragged back into the fray, this time by the Italian mafia, becoming a pawn in a vicious family war.
John Wick films are stylized, very ironic, and cinematically very aware. And as if to impress upon the audience its cinephilic credentials, this one begins with a Sonic Lumiere kind of projection of a silent movie action sequence on a Manhattan skyscraper, before tilting down rapidly to a breakneck chase scene between a muscle car and a motorbike. It's fun, very violent, and doesn't cut away on impact. See it from between your fingers.
So I guess you have a choice. You want a war, or do you want to just give me a gun?
I'm Jason DeRosso. You've been listening to The Final Cut, a Twin Peaks roundtable discussion next week, and Pablo Larraín will be talking about his new film, Neruda. Be sure not to miss it. I'll see you then.